This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran is an assistant managing editor of the Washington Post, where he has worked since 1994. He previously served the Post as a bureau chief in Baghdad, Cairo, and Southeast Asia, and as a correspondent covering the war in Afghanistan. He joins us on the long line. Rajiv, welcome.
Hey, good to be with you today.
I'm so glad you could make some time. I know you are an incredibly busy man, and we appreciate you making some time for the folks here in Central Virginia to discuss your latest book, which is titled Imperial Life in the Emerald City Inside Iraq's Green Zone. Tell me first, how did you wake up one morning and find yourself in the middle of a war?
You know, I started out my career at the Washington Post covering Northern Virginia and actually well down into Central Virginia for a period of a couple of years. And, you know, it's amazing how life can take you from the wonderful hills of the Virginia Piedmont to the deserts of Iraq. But after a couple of different foreign assignments, found myself based in Cairo in the summer of 2002, and, of course, in that lead-up to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, I wound up getting deployed to Baghdad to cover events there. And then immediately upon the liberation of Iraq, I returned to Baghdad and wound up staying there for about 18 months to run the Washington Post's news bureau there to help coordinate our coverage and to write about the American effort to govern and reconstruct post-Saddam Iraq.
And this effort, of course, you told the inside story of what life was like behind these walls, walls built to protect this little outpost there, as it were, in the middle of this war and this safe green zone. Why was it called green?
Well, it initially got the name the Green Zone because it was deemed to be the safe part of Baghdad, the place where Americans could go jogging down the street, where they could drive around without need of a military escort. Of course, over time, parts of the Green Zone became as dangerous as any other place, or at least fairly dangerous. It was a favored target for insurgents to, for instance, shoot mortars into, and there were always insurgents trying to get in with various forms of explosive devices.
Is it safe today, in October of 2006, the Green Zone?
Not really. You know, the Green Zone is now sort of a collection of little enclaves. There is a, while there is a big set of walls around the 7-square-mile area called the Green Zone, now renamed the International Zone, there's sort of mini green zones inside of it. So the American Embassy, for instance, has its own perimeter, its own walls, its own barbed wire, its own guards. And, you know, for instance, the CIA station has its own walls and guards, and as does, for instance, other outposts, the various contractors and all who have set up shop there. So the days of being able to go for nice long runs on the sidewalk are over. People largely now exercise either inside their own little walls or on treadmills.
Assistant Managing Editor of the Washington Post, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, is our guest. His book is Imperial Life in the Emerald City. Phone lines are open, folks, at 977-1070. Rajiv, you were a first-hand witness to our efforts in the very heart of Iraq, right in downtown Baghdad, to create a free society. Tell us what folks like Paul Bremer and what these folks were doing right and where they really have screwed up.
Let me back up for a second, if I could, Coy.
Absolutely.
When I returned to Baghdad on the 10th of April, 2003, the day after the statue of Saddam was pulled down in front of the Palestine Hotel, I was filled with great optimism. You know, I was not one of these people who thought this was all going to be a failure, who was very critical. In fact, I, having lived in Iraq, having known many Iraqis, in many ways was as excited for their liberation as the Iraqi people themselves. And I witnessed firsthand the great enthusiasm the Iraqi people had to be free of Saddam Hussein. It's very hard for us to conceive of it now, but in those days, people weren't really throwing flowers at the troops, but I did see young boys handing cans of Pepsi to soldiers, people being really grateful. When I would introduce myself as a reporter from the Washington Post, I was embraced. I was brought into people's homes. They wanted to talk to me, tell their stories. In fact, I joked that the only danger I faced as an American in those early days was being brought into somebody's house and being served some tea, and I wasn't quite sure where the water was coming from. But over time, and this is what the book is really about, you know, it's an effort to try to explain why we're in the mess that we're in. And there have been a lot of other books on this subject, Coy. You know, my colleague Tom Ricks, for instance, has written a great book called Fiasco.
We've interviewed Tom. He's a good friend, yep.
He's a good friend, and he, you know, he's looked at the military side of things, the disastrous consequences of failing to send enough troops there to stabilize the country upon its liberation, the Pentagon's failure to grasp the growth of the insurgency. Well, what I'm writing in my book is the whole other set of fiascos, and I firmly believe that the civilians who went there to govern and reconstruct Iraq, Ambassador Bremer and his aides, well, they made a whole other set of mistakes that are in many ways just as responsible for getting us into the position that we're in. You know, it was some of the decisions that we know about, for instance, disbanding the Iraqi army, or the way that they went about de-Ba'athification, which put tens of thousands of sort of mid-level Ba'athists, people who had no blood on their hands, people who weren't cronies, put them out of work. But then there were all sorts of other things that really people haven't recognized. You know, these were the people who went to a country with 40% unemployment and said, what we need to do is rewrite their tax code. We need to give them a flat tax. You know, we need to rewrite their laws governing intellectual property and tariffs and foreign investment. Instead of doing the basics in terms of creating jobs, putting people back to work, cleaning the streets, rebuilding government buildings. And I think that we really lost sight of the most important goals at stabilizing a country, and instead delved into a degree of minutiae and micromanagement that really was, in the long run, as we see today, counterproductive.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran is assistant managing editor at The Washington Post. His new book is Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone. You write in your book how so many of these very critical positions of leadership in rebuilding Iraq were actually given to less qualified, in many cases not even at all qualified, Republican Party loyalists. It was sort of like a FEMA writ large. You're my buddy, you supported me in the campaign, I'm sending you to Baghdad.
Exactly. You know, there was a degree of political patronage that went on here. And, you know, it's a White House's prerogative to send political appointees to any sort of mission that it wants to, and to staff elements of the federal bureaucracy. But I believe that a case like rebuilding post-war Iraq, which was so challenging, so fraught with peril, you know, basic logic tells you you want to send your best and your brightest, people who possess skills in Arabic, who have experience in the Middle East, who have prior exposure to post-conflict reconstruction. Instead of making those the key criteria, in many cases, what seemed to be most important was political loyalty. And I'm fond of saying, instead of sending the best and the brightest, in many cases, the loyal and the willing were sent. And people were asked questions in their pre-deployment interviews like, what are your views on Roe versus Wade? Did you vote for George W. Bush in the 2000 election? Are you a member of the Republican Party? And I posit, you know, what does one's views on abortion have to do with rebuilding Iraq? Pro-choice, pro-life, doesn't matter. So long as you can actually get the job done, you possess skills in helping to rebuild power plants, you know how to provide health care in a post-conflict environment, those are the people you need. And unfortunately, the staffing of the Coalition Provisional Authority, the U.S. occupation administration in Iraq, in those crucial first 15 months, the staffing of that bureaucracy was really handled by people who focus in on political appointments in the Pentagon. And I think that was a mistake.
Rajiv, tell us, by way of illustration, the story of the young man who had never worked in finance, who was actually given the job by the Bush administration of creating the Baghdad's new stock exchange.
Yeah, I mean, seemingly inexplicable. 24-year-old kid. He was smart, well-meaning. I don't take that away from him for a second. He was a graduate of Yale University, hard worker, but he hadn't worked in the financial industry. He hadn't worked in the securities industry. And this was the guy who got the job of reopening Baghdad Stock Exchange. You know, it seems kind of outright laughable. There was another case involving health care, where the first person to be sent over there was a U.S. Agency for International Development senior person there who is a physician. He has a master's degree in public health. He has four postgraduate degrees. He had worked in Kosovo and Somalia and northern Iraq after the 91 Gulf War. He's a naval reservist with two Bronze Stars. One of his USAID colleagues has called him the single most talented post-conflict public health specialist working for the U.S. government. But a couple of weeks after Baghdad's liberation, he was told by his bosses at USAID that he was to pack his bags and come home. And he was told that the White House wanted, quote-unquote, a loyalist in the job. I write in the book that this man, Mr. Skip Buerkle, had a wall full of degrees, but he didn't have a picture with the president. And in his place, the White House sent out a guy who was not a doctor, was not a post-conflict public health specialist, was the former director of community health in the state of Michigan. But he was he'd worked for the former Republican governor of that state, John Engler, who recommended him to Paul Wolfowitz. And he got out to Baghdad, and you know, one of his priorities was mounting an anti-smoking campaign. It seemed to be so far removed from the way you would think the federal government should be hiring people for important missions like this. You know, most of the people I talked to for this book are loyal to the core Republicans, and many of them were quite simply aghast the way this was done. You know, their view was, you know, the president would best be served by success in Iraq. Success in the mission is what's most important to the White House. And the way you get that is by sending the best people, not by sending cronies or loyalists.
And when you put all of these instances together over a period of 4 years, what's the end result if you are an Iraqi citizen hoping for the very best?
I think the end result is real frustration. And if you're an Iraqi citizen who really thought that your life was going to improve, that you were happy that the Americans were coming, you wanted change, I think you're left bitterly disappointed. I think that, you know, it's easy for us to say, oh, well, you know, there's that violence there, but at least they're free. But, you know, I talk to a lot of Iraqis on a very regular basis, and they are more scared now than at any time in their modern history. You know, I'm not making any apologies for Saddam, but what they tell me is, at least under the Saddam days, they knew where the red lines were. They knew if they kept their head down, they didn't criticize the government, they'd be okay. Now, they don't know if they're going to live or die when they go to school, when they go to work, when they go to the market, when they go to the mosque. And that's really that's really shaken people up. And then there's a real profound sense of disappointment and, dare I say, depression among the Iraqi people. U.S. officials talk about how other parts of the country, for instance, are far more quiescent. Well, there are parts of the country that are calm, but you know, it's the capital that matters. We know the capital matters because the U.S. Defense Department has deployed a disproportionate amount of troops there. I mean, if people were setting up car bombs every day in Washington, do you think that the American people would be satisfied with an answer saying, "Well, Texas is quiet and West Virginia is quiet, so you know, don't bother covering what's happening in Washington"?
Tom is on the phone in Albemarle. Tom, thanks for the call. You're on with Rajiv Chandrasekaran.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. A question. Why is Iraq so much different than if you take Germany or Japan after World War II, which had their infrastructures decimated, which was probably not so much the case with Iraq? And why so, when these people got a chance for democracy, they took it, they ran with it. What is the difference? It seems like it's more important for the Iraqis to kill each other. And two, as far as the U.S. forces, are we caught in the middle of this? Who's targeting our forces now? Thank you.
Well, there's some key differences here. The first is, you know, Germany and Japan were thoroughly defeated World War II aggressor nations. The Iraqi people never viewed themselves as a thoroughly vanquished nation. They realized that they had a bad man leading their country in Saddam Hussein and his assorted cronies and relatives. But they never regarded themselves, ordinary people, that is, as part of the problem. And so when it came time to decide what to do in a post-Saddam Iraq, the United States went about this by saying, we're going to occupy you with other coalition nations for a period of time until you get back on your feet. And this went over very badly. You know, unlike Germany and Japan, that really had no choice but to have this happen, and I think their people realized that they'd have no choice but to submit to foreign occupation. The Iraqi people looked at, for instance, Afghanistan and said, well, you let them have a loya jirga. You let them come up with an interim government. Why can't we? And I think this really helped poison the atmosphere. I'm not saying that there was an ideal person to hand the keys over to. There was no Iraqi Nelson Mandela or Vaclav Havel or anybody like that, or even a Hamid Karzai that you could have said, here, off and run with it. And, of course, the Iraqi political leaders are a very fractious lot, as we continue to see today. So it's not saying this would have been easy, but it is worth noting that, that occupation went down very poorly in Iraq as opposed to in Germany and Japan. And then the other point that's worth making that I think is fairly obvious to you and your listeners is that Iraq is comprised of different religious and ethnic groups, whereas you have far more religious and ethnic homogeneity in Germany and Japan. So, you know, long-standing rivalries start to bubble to the surface between Sunnis and Shiites, for instance, or Kurds and Arabs. And so you start to see elements of that. And then Tom was asking, you know, are American troops really just getting caught in the middle now? And who's doing the killing? Well, I think that the primary target, the primary culprits these days are the same as they ever were, the Sunni hardline insurgents and ex-Baathists. They're the people, I think, who are really responsible for attacking American forces. But those people are also attacking Shiites, and the Shiites are attacking the Sunnis. We'd like to think that our military is trying to keep a handle on the situation, or at least trying to prevent a greater bloodbath. And I do think they are. You certainly look at news reports and say, what are they really doing? You've got dozens getting killed a day. But I think that if U.S. forces weren't there and we just, for instance, pulled out en masse tomorrow, I think that the daily death toll in the sectarian conflict would go from the many dozens to the many hundreds a day.
Rajiv, and that was my next question. Where do you see this going? Do you see the answers? Perhaps, folks are openly talking about now about partitioning this country we call into Iraq into three separate governments, the Kurds in the north, the Sunnis around the middle, and the Shiites to the south.
Three problems with that, Coy. And, it's easy to sort of seize upon that as kind of a magic bullet solution. But, you create a independent or more autonomous Kurdish region in the north, the independent Shiite region in the south. There's oil in the north and the south. What about the middle? You will have a resource-poor Sunni area that's sandwiched between other countries, landlocked. Sounds an awful lot like Afghanistan. It could be a breeding ground for international terror. Number two, what do you do about Baghdad? It's a multi-ethnic, multi-religious city. Are you going to force people to move across the river? Are you going to force them to give up their homes? It's a city that defies easy partitioning. And number three, by forcing people to move in an effort to divide up the country, you could be precipitating the broader civil war that you're trying to stem. Remember in 1948, for instance, the partitioning of India and Pakistan, just how bloody that was. This could make matters worse rather than better.
Rajiv, tell us about John Agresto. At the very beginning of the book, you have a quote that really jumped out at me. You have this man say, "I'm a neoconservative who's been mugged by reality."
John Agresto, just a gem of a guy. He shows up there to lead the reconstruction of Iraq's higher education system, a subject that is probably near and dear to many people in the Charlottesville area. He's a lifelong Republican. He was friends with Lynn Cheney, the vice president's wife. They both worked together at the National Endowment for the Humanities. Joyce Rumsfeld, the defense secretary's wife, was on his board of directors at St. John's College, a small liberal arts school in New Mexico. He shows up in Baghdad and encounters, an incredibly devastated university system. There are no desks, chairs, blackboards, books in the libraries, science lab equipment, all gone, all decimated by looting. And he discovers that, while he estimates that more than $1 billion is needed to fix Iraq's university system, the White House is only going to pony up about $8 million. And he becomes increasingly disillusioned. He's like, fixing the universities is key to reaching out to the youth and trying to build a new class of more modern, secular, westward-looking Iraqis. And you're not even going to put any money toward this. And then, as the violence increases, his ability to travel out and interact with university leaders and visit university campuses becomes even more restricted. And he begins to conclude that, we Americans think that democracy is really easy to export. And this is a man who would know. He's a professor of philosophy. He's read all the great philosophers in history. And he eventually, you know, starts to raise real questions with our policy toward Iraq and saying, you really can't try to just create democracy overnight. You need to build institutions, a civil society, a functioning bureaucracy, a free press. And if you don't do all of that, you can't expect just to hold elections and everything will be fine. And he becomes so frustrated that by the time he leaves, he and I have one of our many conversations, and he looks to me and he says, I feel like a neoconservative who's been mugged by reality. A very poignant quote.
Rajiv, what is it you think that most Americans don't know or don't perhaps understand about what's going on in Iraq right now that we should know?
I think what most Americans don't fully grasp is the current depth of the tension, the enmity between various groups in Iraq. And also, I need to say corollary or an adjunct to that is that this never really existed before the fall of Saddam and even in the early days of the occupation. If you ask somebody on the street in Baghdad, what are you? They would respond by saying, I'm an Iraqi. And then maybe they would say the tribe they're with. Then only would they perhaps say that they were a Shiite or a Sunni. Now if you ask somebody, the first thing they will say is they're either Sunni or Shia. And, we've unleashed this very, in some way, dangerous, virulent strain of sectarianism in that country. And I don't think it's a genie that can be easily put back into the bottle. And I think that this current degree of violence that we see between religious groups there, I think defies an easy political military solution in the country. I just don't see even, continuing on with trying to professionalize the security services, trying to vet out militiamen from the police forces, for instance, pursuing additional military operations against insurgents. I don't see that getting the Iraqi nation to a state where it can be easily sustainable. Now, you're going to say, well, what do you do then? I don't have a good answer. I think that what Americans have to realize here is that we're going to be in for what I think are many, many more difficult months and years ahead.
It may sound simplistic, and I don't want it to, but do you think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets any better?
I think it will, or I think it's not going to get better anytime soon. I mean, you may well be staying at the current level of violence for a considerable period of time. I just don't see the corner turning anytime soon. And I think that, in trying to understand a lot of this, I think it's instructive to go back to what happened in that first year, in those first 15 months, and look at some of the missed opportunities we had. And that's what I've tried to do. It's an effort to try to understand how we've gotten to the point we have.
The book is Imperial Life in the Emerald City, a gripping account of life inside Iraq's Green Zone. The author, Rajiv Chandrasekaran. Thank you, Rajiv. We appreciate your time and best of luck with the book.
A pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely. This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.